The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to a special Saturday edition of Coffee House Shots. Brexit is done. That's what Boris Johnson likes to tell us. So as we hear some teething issues in terms of the borders, in terms of the arrangements, if we take a step back, how will we look at Brexit in the decades to come? To discuss this, I'm joined by James Forsyth and Robert Toombs, historian and Spectator contributor and the author of the new book, The Sovereign Isle, Britain in and Out of Europe, which aims to put Brexit in its historical context. So to begin, Robert, I think one of the really interesting things that's come from the discussion so far around your book is we've obviously been living through a period where Brexit feels quite stressful, particularly when you've been in Parliament looking at all these knife edge votes for several years. And it has dominated political discourse for several years, less so now clearly with coronavirus. But you suggest that actually in, you know, the time to come, we might look back and say, what was the fuss all about?
Well, that's what I hope. I mean, this is partly because I think history forgets most things. You know, people love saying this will go down in the history books, and hardly anything goes down in the history books except for a tiny number of specialists. And, you know, I don't think we're a very historical culture. We like old things. We like visiting National Trust houses and so on. But the idea that we really have much of an interest in the story and what it all means, I think, is not true, and much less so than in most European countries where the study of history at school up to the age of 18 is compulsory, whereas for us, we stopped doing it, and most kids stopped doing it at 13. So it's partly because we don't remember anything anyway, or hardly anything, except wars. You know, people remember the two world wars, and what else? They remember Henry VIII, and they remember the Battle of Hastings, I suppose, or most people do. But apart from that, the even quite important things get missed out. And so unless Brexit turns out to be an absolute disaster, you know, breaks up the United Kingdom, reduces us all to poverty, and then we go crawling back to the EU, then I don't think people will remember it very much in 20 or 30 years' time.
James, do you think that's fair? The success of Brexit will be, if we fast forward 30 years, no one talking about it at a dinner party and getting really angry.
Yeah, I always thought Brexit was a question of when, not if. Because if you look at the direction that the EU is going, it is striking how few British politicians and what a small segment of the public are actually supportive of that. The idea that, you know, the single currency, that is an idea that in the 90s, huge numbers of the political class were in favour of. In the referendum campaign, everyone wanted to say, well, we'll never have to join the euro, so don't worry about that. And I think you saw that, imagine for a second that Britain had voted Remain. I think it's very hard not to think that the UK would have vetoed the coronavirus recovery fund, the kind of so-called Hamiltonian moment for Europe. And I think that what was striking about the UK was how the argument of the Remain campaign in 2016 was really only about the economic benefits of being in the EU. There was no argument that there is a kind of European demos, for example, that Britain should actively want ever closer union and to be part of a European state. And so for that reason, I always thought the question of when we would leave the EU would be a kind of question of when, not if. Or that, you know, you would see a group within the EU go much further while the UK stayed in some kind of outer periphery. So I think Robert is undoubtedly right in that historical inevitability is a dangerous thing to talk about. But I think it was always highly likely that the UK was going to leave the European political project at some point.
I think in a way that's true. You could say we'd never been really wholly part of it, not being in Schengen, not having the euro, which of course, and the euro I think is the crucial fact of membership. But you know, you were saying we would have vetoed the recovery package, but then when Cameron in the past had tried to veto things, said, well, we'll do it by a separate agreement between the EU states who want to go along with it. And I'm sure that would have happened again. Because I think one thing one realises about the EU is, although it proclaims itself to be, you know, a rules-based, a law-based organisation, it isn't really. It proceeds on a sort of Machiavellian basis of doing precisely what it thinks is necessary and ignores the law or changes the law as it sees fit. I think what Cameron's negotiations or attempted negotiations proved is that we had at that time practically no influence, and certainly not sufficient influence to stop the EU from doing things that it really wanted to do. Now, were we therefore destined to leave? Well, you could say, well, the fact that we did proves that we were, but, you know, the narrowness of our actually leaving, or the terms on which we left, seemed to me to show that it wasn't necessarily inevitable. At least, you could say, if we had a referendum, it was very likely that people would vote to leave. And that was probably true, had been true for 20 years. But what about if we had a referendum and voted to leave, as we did, and then somehow this was stopped? Somehow we didn't really leave, we only half left, we stayed as an associate member of the EU. And it seems to me that could very easily have happened. Or indeed, sorry, we're all in the hypotheticals now, what about if another 2% of people had voted differently and we'd had a knife-edge vote to remain in 2016? Would there have been another chance? You imagine that, you know, once in a generation, all that stuff. So 20 years on, if the EU is still there, which it might not be, would we not be so far into it that we'd never be able to leave again?
I mean, that's a fascinating point. And I think that the Dutch example, I think, is very interesting. The Dutch joined the single currency. If you look at those kind of Eurobarometer polling, Dutch public opinion on Europe is actually not that different to where UK public opinion was 20 years ago. I think, though, the fact that the Netherlands has entered the euro, has the single currency, now means that leaving is simply too big of a leap there. I don't think the Dutch will ever leave. And I think that is in part because once you have joined the single currency, the cost of exit become prohibitively high. I think if Remain had won very narrowly in 2016, I think it's almost inevitable that the next leader of a Conservative Party, given the way the Tory parliamentary party and Tory membership would have voted, would have been a leaver. And so I think the issue would have come back onto the political agenda.
Just on that, I suppose if we are going to go into the world of hypotheticals, I'm just going to throw another in for good measure, which is we can talk about what would have happened, you know, if the EU referendum vote had gone differently. But I wondered, Robert, there was a point when Theresa May got pretty close, never close enough to passing her Brexit deal. Had we gone for that, which in a way did seem to be a lot more of a halfway house in terms of that relationship with the EU, how do you think that would have changed, I suppose, the long-term ramifications of Brexit as it would then be defined, which would be something quite different in terms of how close it would operate?
Well, you know, all these are hypotheticals and we're just saying what we think might have happened or what sounds quite likely. Well, we would have been stuck in a sort of halfway house. We would have been rule takers of the EU, which of course it may turn out that we still are, conceivably, but we would have been very obviously under the economic and political control of the EU to a large extent without having a voice in decisions. That would, I think, not have been thought to be a satisfactory outcome. And therefore, the conflict would almost certainly have continued between those who would have said, well, look, you know, what's the advantage of being half out of the EU when we're not really independent, and it would be much better if we were in, and therefore we would rejoin over the years. All those who would have said, well, look, you know, again, this is an entirely unsatisfactory position to be, you know, a vassal state of the EU, as someone's called it, I think maybe the Prime Minister, and therefore there would have been more pressure to leave. So I think, you know, compromise is not always the most sustainable position. It seems to me, in this case anyway, it would just have perpetuated the conflict. But I must say I agree absolutely with James, and this is a point I make in the book. Being in the Eurozone or not is the crucial thing. And countries in which the EU is much more unpopular than it is or was in Britain, obviously Greece and Italy, and France too indeed, cannot contemplate leaving because they cannot contemplate the danger to the financial system that leaving the euro would involve. And, you know, this is partly sort of abstract, what happens to the public finances. And we know that this can mean that your banking system collapses overnight, or at least that's a danger. But it also means that your savings in your savings bank might well be halved overnight if you return to a national currency which then is devalued. And the idea that people are going to take that kind of risk, as James said, I think would have been unthinkable for us too. So I think, you know, had we been in the euro, we would not have dared to vote to leave in 2016. And hence, I think I say in the book somewhere that the true architect of Brexit is Gordon Brown. because keeping us out of the euro meant that Brexit was possible, and for the reasons James suggested earlier, arguably inevitable in the long run.
I also think that the other thing that not joining the euro meant was that Britain's self-perception of itself as a nation had to see itself as leading in Europe. From the moment we didn't join the euro, it meant that we couldn't be a leading voice in the EU, because the most important political and economic project of the EU now is the single currency, and we were not part of that. And then I think to pick up on something Robert said earlier, I think that moment when David Cameron attempted to veto a Eurozone treaty and the Eurozone went ahead anyway, kind of round the side, I think that was also a sign that ultimately the Eurozone would act to protect its own interests, even at the expense of other EU member states that were not in the euro. And I think that was another big step on the road to Brexit. I think that various people in government who ended up campaigning for leave said that that was the moment, because they were like, right, it's on this particular question, our veto makes no difference. The veto was meant to be the protection. And if the veto could be got round as easily as that veto was, what protections do you really have?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, do you think that any European member state now effectively has a veto? I mean, you might say, well, Germany must, but is it only Germany, or does even Germany? For example, if any country had wanted to stop the COVID rescue package, which I think most people agree was inadequate, but nevertheless, as a gesture, something had to be done, do you think even Germany could have said, we're not going to pay? Or would they have been overruled as well?
I think one fascinating thing about the COVID crisis is it has shown that national governments, that even within the EU, national governments matter. And I thought it was a telling moment in the crisis when the French impounded some supplies of PPE that were meant to be going to Sweden on the grounds that they wanted to check that they had enough first before they went. And I think there's a fascinating question about how people will view Brexit is, you know, what is the success of the UK's vaccination programme compared to the EU vaccination programme? You already see the kind of political row in Germany with people saying, well, hang on a second, why are we getting so few doses of this vaccine that was discovered in Germany? Why is this process taking so long? So I think national governments in the EU do have power if they are prepared to use them, even at the risk of being overruled. I think one of the issues for the UK was that we have a very cautious approach to what we are prepared to do within an organisation. I think that was one of the things that drove our frustration with the EU.
Yeah, but it's interesting what you say. I mean, I think that's true, and I agree that the whole COVID thing is proving to be the first test of Brexit, but also of the EU post-Brexit. Is that, as you say, European governments can do things, but not through the EU's institutions. They can do it by ignoring or disobeying and doing things on their own, but they can't do things through the system. Is that true?
I think there certainly is some truth to that. And I think it'll be a very interesting question that you already see at the moment that the German government, for example, have been buying up unused allocations under the EU vaccine scheme from other countries. But I think that does create an interesting question, which is, in this era of pandemics and disease with border controls coming back, how are people going to feel about free movement, for example, in a situation where I think we're probably, Katie and I were discussing this on podcast earlier, we're probably in for a kind of prolonged period of tighter border controls as an attempt at pandemic management. How does the kind of EU vision of a borderless Europe fit within that?
And what we have, in a sense, is, again, what you were saying earlier, the EU is reduced to its irreducible core, which is the management of the Eurozone. Even if, you know, if the Schengen area ceased to function, which arguably it has, if the free market was blocked, if EU initiatives of things like purchase of vaccine were ignored, nevertheless, what remains is the European Central Bank and its attempts to keep the currency in existence. And that can't disappear, as it were, that, or at least if it did, it would be an absolute catastrophe.
James, when we're, I suppose, trying to assess Brexit now, also years to come, obviously the problem is we're only seeing the beginning of it in this current form. And I wondered, you mentioned the vaccine programme. I think a lot has been made of the fact that it has become almost one of the best adverts for being outside of the EU for lots of people, and something that is tangible and they can actually see. But we're also seeing lots of reports in terms of issues in Northern Ireland, in terms of food. We're hearing about fishermen in Scotland, and obviously certain ministers will tell us that's not specifically to do with Brexit. But when do you think we'll be at a point where, I suppose, politically, and this is, I think, probably less about that historical context in years to come, but politically, we'll have a sense of how this deal is working out for all these different communities?
I think we're probably a decade or so away from that. I think the one immediate factor that I think would make Brexit to be seen as a failure would be if, as Robert said at the beginning, if the UK broke up in response, if the Scots decided to leave. And so it's probably a decade to see that. But I also think that it will take a long time, because it's also about what happens to the EU. Where does the EU go? And I ultimately think that to make a success of a single currency, the EU will end up having to go become a proper transfer union, because I think that's the only way you can make the single currency work in the long term.
And Robert, just touching on that, and it'd be interesting to hear your general response to what James has just said, but also for talking about the union, I mean, is it fair to say that what would stop Brexit from being almost a footnote, something that we don't overly obsess on in, you know, decades to come, would be the breakup of the union? Something like Scotland going independent would change how we looked about Brexit, and it would become much more, I suppose, historically significant, would you say?
Yes, definitely. Except it seems to me, and I wrote this in The Spectator, it's really the membership of the EU that makes separation of countries like Scotland or Catalonia, at least so they thought, possible, because small countries within the EU, there's a lot of attraction to that sort of status, not least for their politicians. You don't have to worry about your security, you don't have to worry about negotiating trade arrangements with other countries, you're welcomed into the bosom of Brussels and so on. But once you're outside, as we are now, it seems to me not unthinkable, but at least impractical for Scotland to vote for separation from the UK. It would be an enormous risk, and indeed would the EU encourage it? If it did, of course, that would be regarded, no doubt, by the UK government as a seriously unfriendly act and would cause a crisis. But leaving that on one side, why would any Scots voter, except for, let's say, the most passionate, want to take such a risk when the advantages are extremely uncertain or, if not, non-existent? In practical terms, you know, people say, oh, yeah, but people don't think about that now. People think about identity, which I don't really think is true. At least if they think about identity, they don't only think about that. They also think about the money in their pocket, in their bank account, as our vote in 2016 showed. I don't really see how Scottish independence is conceivable after Brexit in a way that it was very easily conceivable before Brexit. Now, again, if Brexit is going to be an absolute disaster in other ways, then you could see the Scottish electorate being convinced that they had to get out of this disaster. But there's not much sign of Brexit being a disaster. It may be, in some senses, a nuisance, but hardly a disaster. Why would, let's say, uncertain Scottish electors want to take such a risk? Northern Ireland, I suppose, is different, as it's fairly evenly balanced. But I think serious surveys of opinion show that very few people in Northern Ireland are in favour of immediate union with the Republic. A very small proportion. Simply because, again, the economic consequences of leaving the United Kingdom for Northern Ireland would be enormous. It's often said that the Irish Republic is richer now than the UK, but that's a bit of a fraud. The standard of living in the South is much lower than in the North. No national health service, that kind of thing. And I think people, again, would have to say to themselves, you know, I might like the idea of Scotland being independent or Northern Ireland being part of the Irish Republic, but what's it going to cost me? And I think there are limits on what people are willing to pay for independence, as our own referendum showed, because the number of people who felt negative views of the EU, which were the same in Britain as in Germany, Spain, less than in France and so on, was reduced to the barest majority for leaving, as we know. And most people said that they'd voted Remain because they were afraid of the economic consequences. And I think we should not forget that. People do vote with their economic interests in mind and don't just go for utopian solutions because they think it sounds nice.
James, couldn't we argue, actually, if Brexit isn't seen as a disaster, you know, after all the Project Fear warnings, after all these, you know, predictions not coming true, that actually that could be used as an argument by nationalists in Scotland and other places to say, we could do this and look, it wasn't a disaster for them, so why would it be a disaster for us?
I think the difficulty for the SNP in doing that is that they very much tried to invent the SNP as a European country, this argument that Scotland has a European destiny but is different from England's. And I think that makes it hard for them. And the point that, as Robert says, is that pre-Brexit, all Alex Salmond had to do, all in inverted commas, in 2014, was persuade people that Scotland could join the EU successfully. And then you could argue that the relations with the rest of the UK economy would carry on much as before. Right now, it is clear that if Scotland were to join the EU, there would be friction at the border. There would be friction at Berwick. And you cannot claim that everything would carry on as before, but just an independent Scotland would be a member of the EU. Because the UK is outside the customs union and the single market now, if Scotland left the UK and joined the EU, that would create economic barriers between Scotland and the rest of the UK.
So do you not take seriously the opinion polls that show, or at least those opinion polls that show a small majority in favour of independence?
I think you have to take the polls seriously. I think there is clearly a rising desire for Scottish independence. But I think one of the things that is striking about it is how many voters are, as one might put it, lightly decided. And I think a lot of the current support for independence is based around the popularity of Nicola Sturgeon, her success at framing Scottish politics as a choice between whether you would prefer her or Boris Johnson. And I think that while the union is in a moment of maximum danger right now, I still think that when it came to a campaign, there are a series of very difficult questions for the Scottish nationalists to answer. And I think it's quite interesting to come back to your earlier point, which is, someone I know has done some polling where you try and flip the question around and basically ask, would you rather stay in the UK with the pound or become an independent country with the euro? And that flips the maths from where it is now in terms of voter opinion.
Yeah, that's very interesting. But then it seems to me the real problem may well be in the long term, not so much whether the Scots will vote to become independent or not, but how we reconfigure the United Kingdom in some way that means that Scottish electors do not feel alienated from the whole UK system. And that seems to me very difficult for Scottish politicians to become involved in English or in British government. You know, yeah. The way that the thing has become set up because of the dominance of the SNP means that Scotland is now, as it were, permanently in opposition to any conceivable British government, unless you were to imagine a coalition between Labour and the SNP in some future date. But at least in the foreseeable future, the SNP is out, and therefore Scotland, or many Scottish voters, will feel themselves to be entirely outside the UK's political power structure. How do you think we deal with that?
I think that has to be a question of some more devolution within England that allows you to get to a slightly more federal system than we have now. So there'd be no obstacle to having someone sitting for a Scottish seat as either Prime Minister or Chancellor. I mean, that has to be the answer. I mean, some kind of constitutional reform that allows you to do that.
Well, I wonder if English voters would find that a price worth paying. I mean, there are plenty of people in England who would quite like Scotland to become independent. The idea of splitting up England to suit the Celtic nations, if you like, has been around for an awfully long time. I think Churchill suggested it in 1910, because otherwise you can't obviously see how you, as you say, have a federal system in which one of the units is so much larger than the others. But then would English electors go for some sort of partition of England in order to suit the Scots?
This is the question, which is, I think the problem with the Blairite desire for kind of regional assemblies was that these were regions that people felt no great attachment to. I think if you were going to do some kind of division of England in terms of political power, it would have to be based on counties. And I don't think that's a bad unit. The population of Kent is roughly equivalent to the population of Northern Ireland, say. I mean, counties are the local unit of government that people feel some sense of attachment to. And so I think any kind of plan for devolution in England, rather than being a kind of regional system, you know, like the East Midlands, that people don't feel any particular sense of identity with, it would have to be based around kind of Nottinghamshire instead.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Robert. And thank you for listening. And if you would like to pre-order, because it's not out quite yet, Robert's new book, you can do so, not in physical bookshops for now, but online. I'm not going to plug any websites, but you guys know the drill. It is released on January the 28th.